From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a cool harvest day in the Finger Lakes when the crush pads across the region were cranking. At Hosmer Winery on Cayuga Lake, head winemaker Julia Hoyle had just unloaded another stack of bins when a customer wandered over. He was impressed, he told her, and he added, quote, "You drive that forklift like a man." Julia stopped counting how often she heard that by just her second harvest as the head of winemaking in 2017. And perhaps more than most people in the industry, she's especially well-suited to understand the gender dynamics at work. Julia attended Hobart and William Smith Colleges, focusing on both French and women's studies. She found a passion in the Finger Lakes wine scene, and yet you couldn't blame her if she thinks back to her studies often, especially when someone finds out that she works in the wine industry and then asks her, "Oh, which tasting room do you work in?" Now, there's nothing wrong with tasting room work, but there has been a persistent lack of diversity in the industry on the winemaking side. According to the Wine Market Council and a recent Nielsen study, 57% of American wine consumers are women. But wine trade associations estimate that only 5% of winemakers in New York State are women. In Washington State, it's 7%. In California, it's just 10%. One of the women making wine in the Finger Lakes is Nova Catamatre, who was one of the first graduates of Cornell's burgeoning viticulture and enology program back in 2006. Nova not only pursued winemaking, she worked to earn her Master of Wine, a qualification issued by the Institute of Masters of Wine in the UK. Around the world, it's recognized as the most difficult program to complete in the industry. Today, there are only around 400 living MWs in the world. There are only around 40 in the United States. Many are winemakers, and of them, all of them are men. Until Nova. She was the first woman. This week, some of the leading Riesling producers from around the world are in the Finger Lakes for a conference called the FL Excursion. There will be a focus on winemaking, climate change, marketing, and more. And I wonder if there will be any conversation about the slow progress in diversifying the industry. We asked Julia Hoyle and Nova Catamatre to join us from the WEOS studios in Geneva, Finger Lakes Public Radio, and that's where they are. Julia Hoyle, it is wonderful to have you on the program. Can you tell me, what does it mean to drive a forklift like a man?
I still don't know. Maybe, you know, you don't drive into things. I'm not sure what they mean by it, but it's rude every time.
It's wonderful to have you. Thanks for taking time, Julia. Nova Catamatre, owner and winemaker at Trestle 31 on Seneca Lake. Nova, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
We're not just going to be talking about diversifying the industry. Both of you are here on the program for the first time, and we're just going to talk about your work, particularly if we can put a fine point on it, at a time where some of your colleagues who are here from Europe are dealing with devastating flooding, and it is a hard time. The wine industry worldwide, it's been very, very difficult, and climate change has accentuated the challenges this year. We're going to get to that coming up here. But let me just ask you, Julie, a little bit more here. How often do you think about about women's studies that you studied at HWS back in, 2009 or so?
Yep, quite frequently, especially on the winemaking side of things. There's a lot of young women in the industry now. A lot of them are maybe at the assistant level. And when you think about an industry growing, you think about who's going to be stepping up. And it makes me wonder, you know, is our industry truly going to fully embrace that and have these women at the top level in a company, or are they just assistants? Because there is a difference there. And I think about that a lot.
I'm glad you bring that up, because when we talk about diversifying any industry, and whether we're looking at, just numbers of people of color who work for companies, Fortune 500 companies, one thing that tends to happen is there is kind of an effort that to hire, but usually on entry-level positions, middle management perhaps, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And even as companies start to diversify, whether it's more women, people of color, we often don't see that at the top levels.
Correct.
And you're pointing directly to that by saying there's, even if we see doors open in winemaking to women, head winemaking jobs are still hard to come by. Why do you think that is, Julia?
I think part of it's just, you know, it's people have this idea, oh, it's a physical job. It must be a man's job, which is ridiculous. They have no reason to say that. Right. And I think a lot of it just comes down to the physical nature of it and where the industry has come from historically. And it's this really hard set idea that men do that labor. And, you know, every time there's another woman that's in a vineyard manager position or a head winemaker position, they're breaking that apart. They're making you rethink it. And that goes for a person of color, that also goes for LGBTQ, that all of these categories of people that have to push a little harder to get somewhere. Every time you have someone in that position opening a door, I think it's important to reach behind you and pull somebody else in.
Nova, do you agree with that analysis that that we're seeing more and more assistant winemakers, women in different positions, but still fewer at the top levels, and there's still some resistance or stereotyping?
Absolutely. Yeah, the stat you published about California earlier, about 10% of the women or 10% of the winemakers are women, that only counts top level lead winemakers. That does not include assistants or enologists or vineyard people coming up through, So I do see more women coming into the industry, but as Julia said, it really is at the entry level, and you're still seeing it's very, very difficult for women and other underrepresented groups to move up into those top spots.
What is it going to take, Nova, to start making that change? Or are you seeing it slowly move?
I am seeing it slowly move, but I think, perception and, the idea that of what a winemaker is and who they are and what they look like is very strongly cemented in our cultural identity. And that has to change before I think this is more accepted. I mean, because I am a lead winemaker, but I also am a woman, and I like to wear heels and things with sequins and shiny things. And when I go to an event, I like to dress up, and I can't tell you how many times somebody looks at me and go, oh, so you're the marketing person, mm-hmm. And that's really challenging. And also you have to figure out as a woman, how do you insert I'm the winemaker without sounding like you're tooting your own horn too much. And so it's a really fine balance between sounding too confident and too cocky and being too demure and not taking credit for what you're doing.
Yeah. Julia, do you get that same question that, you must work in marketing or PR, that kind of thing?
I absolutely do. Sure, you put on heels because I do wear my winery boots most days, but sometimes I want to be 6 feet tall, and those little things help you command a room in ways that, I will look nice. But if we're going to have a conversation, I am the winemaker. Hey, let's talk about that. Let's not make assumptions about each other.
Julia, without sort of naming names, I guess I'm curious if both of you have ever had an experience where you're talking to someone who thinks that they are pretty progressive, pretty cultured, but they are talking in a way that still perpetuates stereotypes. Do you experience that? And every day we're all getting older. We're all pretty young, okay? We're all around the same age. We're all pretty young. But as you get older, do you find yourself more willing to sort of challenge it directly, Julia?
Yes, I do. And early on, I had an experience where, and I will come out with this, so my spouse is the winemaker at Red Newt, and early on, someone looked at me and said, well, I mean, Kelby's on a great trajectory with his career. Why do you need to work? And this is an industry person that I was working in a cellar, right? There's clearly interest there. And I still hold that nugget close to me, and it's, in a weird way, kind of what drives me. And certainly Kelby and I don't have competition between each other, but to have someone early in your career just look at you and go, why are you working? You don't need to work. Mm. I love the work, and I will be here and I will take up space.
If that same comment hit your ears today, would you respond any differently than you did at the time?
At the time, yes, because back then I just kind of heard it and was taken aback and didn't say much. Usually my go-to reaction now is, what do you mean by that?
Oh, that's good.
That's a good response.
Turn it around. Almost make them reconsider the meaning of what, or sort of really think more deeply about what they're saying.
Huh? Yep. They usually get a little awkward.
Good, right?
Yes. I want them to feel uncomfortable. They said something that made me feel uncomfortable.
Nova, do you find that there are people who fancy themselves as pretty progressive or cultured people and yet are still, sort of peddling stereotypes?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll give you an example that my husband ran into, actually, that's kind of the opposite somewhat, I guess, of Julia. So my husband also has a career in the wine industry and has done quite well for himself, given the fact that he has pretty much taken a back seat to my career. And we've always moved with my career, which is opposite of the traditional gender roles. And he was at a company where his boss was actually a female, and he had to leave early to go pick our kids up from school. And he said, "Hey, I've got to go. I've got to go pick my kids up." And she turned around straight to him and said, "Can't your wife do that?" And he turned around to her and he said, "My wife has a more important job than I do, so no." And it was great because it was one of those things where he just shut her down. But those assumptions about what we as women should be doing and what is proper and not proper are so still prevalent today. It's so hard to deal with. But, you know, luckily, you know, both Julie and I have really supportive spouses. And I think that makes it a little bit easier to handle some of those things.
But no, that's like the wine industry equivalent of a political candidate, a woman who's running for office being asked, but what about your children? When the man's never asked that, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly.
That is the equivalent. And the reason I wanted to have this conversation today is because, you know, at a time when the Finger Lakes industry is right at the center of this conference and the world's wine attention is here, and there's so much to celebrate, when I hear these stories, it's tough. You wonder what is going to actually create the change. And so, let's talk about sort of what comes next here, because what Nova and Julia are doing, they're in two different positions. I mean, Nova is the owner running the operation, co-owner, and, you know, has the autonomy to do that. Julia was hired at Hosmer. And you became head winemaker, remind me, 2016, 2017, Julia?
2017 was my first vintage. I started at the very, very end of 2016. So I blended those wines, but didn't have a hand during fermentation.
Okay, and I'm hopeful that you're going to tell me that nobody ever blinked about hiring a woman to be the head winemaker at a time where very few women are head winemakers in the Finger Lakes. But what were those conversations like, and what was that process like at Hosmer?
Very fluid, actually, because I am the third female winemaker for the Hosmer family, mm-hmm. Which I don't think everyone realizes that. Once Cameron Hosmer, so Cameron and Marin, started the business, when he decided, you know, I'm going to step away from also doing the winemaking, his first hire was a woman. And he's had, I think I'm his fifth winemaker, if I'm getting it right. And of those five, three have been women.
Why do they get it when so many others are struggling?
Cameron and Marin are just, I think their ethos is, hey, you want to do the work, you're good at your job, we see you as that. And, you know, like anyone, we're constantly learning how to move in our worlds, but they're both skiers. Marin's a super competitive skier. She's on the board for the New York State, I think, high school girls ski team. And, you know, if you're working with young women in a competitive environment, you get it. You get that there are barriers that you directly or indirectly are going to have to deal with. And they just didn't bat an eye.
Julia, what do young women and even girls who are thinking of their future careers, have you had questions? Have you had, maybe comments sent your way about, aspiring careers and how difficult it is? And if so, what are you telling people?
I think I haven't had, direct questions in that way. But one thing that I have held true for a long time, and some of this I'm like, I was raised Quaker, right? It's that Quaker bone in me, is sometimes just keep your nose down and you know what is right and stick to it. And sometimes when you speak up, it's that much more powerful. But just keep working away at trying to make the changes that you hope to see. And when you do raise your voice in a room of people, it will be heard, I guess.
I am unbelievably ignorant on what it means to be Quaker, beyond just the broad outlines. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So I would say one of the core things, so I grew up outside of Philadelphia, about 10 minutes north. And, you know, if you're trying to make a decision, Quaker process, every single person has to agree. So if one person dissents, you pause on the decision until every single person agrees. And that's a really good exercise to learn. So when my school wanted to expand because they needed more space and they wanted to build off the high school, there's one member of the meeting, which was entrusted with the school, that for, 8 or 9 years, dissented. and they did not expand the school for 8 or 9 years. And one day she, you know, a conversation and agreed that, you know, this is for the best and this all works and I'm okay with this. We can move ahead. But it makes you, you know, negotiate. And that's a really important skill, I think, to start learning as a child. I also had siblings, so that helps with that sort of negotiating. But it's a really important skill set as a child and carry through into your adult life.
First of all, you're not going to be surprised that that's like the total opposite of Amazon and Jeff Bezos culture. Where
I don't shop on Amazon.
I kind of thought you didn't. I kind of thought you didn't. Amazon's culture is that everyone can share an opinion, but once a decision's made, even if you believe the opposite, you better get on board and pull in the same direction.
Yes.
I understand sort of the value for a capitalistic enterprise of that, but I also have a great affection for what you're describing. I am curious to know how that ethos has affected or informed your winemaking and maybe how you navigate it when there is disagreement, but you have a strongly held opinion or, you know, you feel like a decision has got to be made in some direction.
Mm-hmm. So I think one thing I keep in mind is if I do disagree, and especially in a small company, you're never all going to agree, is that all those opinions are valid. And you just have to remember that and that they're coming from a place. Whether or not that is the same place as you. And, you know, if there's something that I feel very strongly about, I make that be known. Sometimes that means you might need to take a step back, take a deep breath, be a little less emotional about it or a little less angry about it, or, you know, just try and calm yourself down, have the conversation. But just because your opinion you think is correct doesn't mean that everyone else is coming from the wrong place. So I try and take that into my work. Also fermentations, right? You have plan A. By the end of harvest, you are probably on plan Z. And just being very comfortable with knowing that, again, there's no one exact right way to do things. And you just kind of have to roll with the punches. And Mother Nature forces you to be okay with that. So yeah, I guess those would be my two sort of every opinion is valid. And you just sometimes have to be reminded of that kernel of truth. And hey, yeah, roll with the punches. It'll be okay.
It does sound to me that your Quaker roots promote real humility and a real open-minded process that I think is really beautiful and important. I'm talking to Julia Hoyle, who is the head winemaker at Hosmer Winery in Cayuga Lake. And they've been there for many decades. They're a fixture in the Finger Lakes industry. And Julia has been their head winemaker since the 2017 vintage. Her wines, I mean, she'll tell you they're not just her wines, but for the shorthand, I will say her wines are beautiful and expressive and just so exciting to me. I am a big fan of Julia's work. Nova Catamatres here, owner and winemaker of Trestle 31 on Seneca Lake. And Julia's time's a little limited, so I've just got a few more questions for Julia, because where are you? What are you running off to? You've got so much to do with this for the conference today.
Yeah, I have a wine, Stuart Piggott, so one of the Riesling critics of the world and Riesling writers. He has a Hosmer wine on the upcoming panel at 2:00, so I got to scoot off, and Cameron Hosmer is also going to be in the room, and we'll be there to talk about the wine.
That's great. Winemakers popping in virtually and in person from around the world here for FL Excursion, and it's been a great few days already. Abby Fanning, who is the owner and operator of Cheshire, a wonderful cocktail bar in Rochester, says, Evan, let's also get women into sales reps positions, women into bar ownership. When people are shocked that I am the owner of the bar, I always ask him if that's because I'm too young or just too pretty. And she had a good laugh at that. She likes to make people feel awkward when they ask stupid questions.
Yep.
Evie, thank you. And I think I've been around when people have asked Evie that question. And that's a big mistake whenever people ask that. I appreciate that, Evie. Couple questions from listeners. Carly says, Evan, great topic. This conversation could most certainly include local gem, wine, and lifestyle writer Maya Johnson Dunn, who aspires to open the first Black-owned and operated FLX winery. Absolutely. In fact, we had Maya on for an hour, just one-on-one, not that long ago, Carly, and I would encourage you, I would dig it up myself, but I'm sitting here in the studio, but that conversation, if you haven't heard, I was going to say, that conversation is worth checking out, but producer Megan Mack has already sent you the link, because Megan Mack, who's the real brains of this operation, is ahead of me. So, Carly, enjoy that. I appreciate that. Greg says, Evan, you say that 57% of wine consumers are women. Does that mean 57% of winemakers should be women? How many until you would be satisfied? Okay, Greg, it's not that I'm dissatisfied. I'm just pointing out that I don't think 5% is representative of the interest, and I don't think that's what an open door and equity looks like. But I'll ask Julia and Nova to answer that. Julia, Greg says, how many until you'd be satisfied?
I guess when you get to the point that I would be introduced as a winemaker and not a woman winemaker.
Yes. When we stop having this conversation and it starts being normal enough for us not to have this conversation, then we will be satisfied.
That's a great standard. And, you know, maybe I'm part of the problem there. But I also admit that when I look at the numbers, I feel like I have to keep talking about this, because we are still so far from where we ought to be. Julia, what excites you most about what's happening in the industry in the Finger Lakes right now?
Ooh, right now? I think just the level of experimentation. Because a lot of us have very classic portfolios, but I also think that we're in a place that we're experimenting and thinking ahead about, hey, what's going to grow well here in 10, 20, 30 years, or trialing new techniques that, you know, winemaking techniques, just like grape varietals, they ebb and flow, they are popular and that pulls back and something else is popular. But we're in a region that has a relatively wide open door to grow whatever varietals you want to grow or use whatever various technique you might be interested in the winery. And we can do that. And no one's going to say, hey, no, you're not allowed to grow that here. So I think just the level of trial, experimentation, we have Cornell in the backyard that also is doing really cool research. It's just a fun time to be in the region.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, Riesling is so much at the center of what's happening, and deservedly so. But is there a variety that you're working with that maybe 5 years ago you would have been surprised that you like it this much?
You know, I'd worked a little bit with Sauvignon Blanc in Australia. Gruner, totally new for me to work with when I started at Hosmer. I'm still figuring them out, but they're really fun to work with, and they're fun to figure out. So it's the puzzle pieces that are fun.
So I happened to have a glass of your Sauvignon Blanc last weekend. And putting your nose in that glass is like the equivalent of opening a huge wooden door on the street when you think it's quiet and all of a sudden you didn't realize that an amazing orchestra is and the music just floods out and you go, whoa, I was not ready for that. That was beautiful. And so, yeah. Cheers, and I want to thank you. I know you got a roll.
Yep.
But thank you for making time for this program, and I'll follow your lead by saying you are a winemaker. You're not a woman winemaker. You're a winemaker, and we are thrilled that you're helping lead this industry. Thanks for doing what you're doing, Julia.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
You're Julia Hoyle, winemaker at Hosmer Winery on Cayuga Lake. She's off to participate in FL Excursion, which is a conference happening in the Finger Lakes last few days and for the next few days. And they've got winemakers and industry professionals not only popping in via Zoom, but coming here from around the world. So Julia's off to do that. We're going to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and talk to Nova Cademetre about her career here. She's the owner and winemaker at Trestle 31 on Seneca Lake, and we'll do that on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. Are vaccine booster shots needed? Government health officials say they aren't necessary right now, but Pfizer and other companies are trying to make the case. How will we know how viable the boosters might be and when we might need them? What are the ethical responsibilities when some countries have very little vaccine supply? We're joined by local vaccine researchers talking about the issues on Tuesday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important best told sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In the world today, there's just over 400 masters of wine worldwide, just about 40 in the United States. Many of them are winemakers, and for a while, all the winemakers who were MWs in this country were men, until Nova Catamatre cracked that ceiling wide open. And if you don't mind, Nova, who's joining us from our WEOS studios, Finger Lakes Public Radio in Geneva, if you could describe for listeners what it takes to become an MW, because that will dissuade anyone who actually wants to try. I'm mostly kidding, but
I hope it doesn't dissuade people. It's a great process. Yes. Yeah, so the short answer is it's set up as a 3-stage program. You go into the first stage, and that's kind of just your prep and getting into the program. The second stage is you're running up to sit the exam, which is a 4-day long exam consisting of a practical section, which is the tasting portion, and a theory section. The practical section is broken to 3 days of 12 wines each, so that's 36 wines total, blind, and you have 2 hours and 15 minutes to answer questions about each of the wines, including variety, vintage, where they're from, how they were made, what their commercial position would be, how they would be marketed, who would be drinking them, that type of thing. So that's the practical section. The theory section is now, it used to be 4 papers, now it's 5 papers, and the first section is viticulture, the second section is winemaking, the third paper is QAQC, shipping, consumer complaints, like how do you handle those types of things, that's the third section. Fourth section is the business sales and marketing, and you have to show mastery of 3 global markets in the world. And then the fifth section is what's called contemporary issues. And so that covers wine and health and philosophy and environmental issues and things like that. And so as a master wine candidate, you have to pass both the practical and the theory sections of the exam. And then you move on to the research paper, which is a 10,000-word paper of original research. And then once you pass that and sign the code of conduct, then you're admitted into the Institute of the Masters of Wine as a Master of Wine.
Wow. Did I have that right? It's 40-something in this country now, right?
Something like that, yes. I know we just had some more folks graduate, so I'm not up to date on the current number exactly.
A few dozen. It's not that many.
It's not very many. No, we like to say globally there's more people that have been in space than have become masters of wine. So that, and of course, that number is about to get much higher with everybody else going to space now, too. So that was just previous to this year.
Amazing. And when did you become an MW?
I became an MW in 2017. And it took me 8 years to accomplish that.
What was that day like?
Oh, it was unbelievable. And it took me about a year to let it completely sink in. Like it was amazing.
You took about 8 years to do it. So you decided to really embark on that. What, about 2009? You had graduated from the Cornell program in viticulture and enology in what, 2006?
2006. And the next year I decided to become an MW in 2007. I went right into the WOCT Advanced in 2007 and got that, went into the diploma program in 2008, finished my second year of the diploma in 2009, and did my first year of the Master of Wine concurrently in 2009. And I sat the exam for the first time in 2010.
Why did you decide you wanted to do it?
Well, it really comes back to what we were talking about earlier. Like I felt like coming out of Cornell, people would take me seriously with that degree. And what I found is they really didn't. And so I said, okay, well, now I need to really do something impressive so that people will take me seriously when I say something. And so then I found the Master of Wine. I was like, oh, that's the top certification that there exists. And so I'm going to go do that. And so, actually a male colleague of mine was sitting there when I made that decision, and we were sharing an office at the time. And I said, oh, I'm going to become a Master of Wine. And he turns around to me, he laughs. He goes, nobody really does that. I was like, well, I'm going to. And so that's what I did. And it was an amazing journey, and one that taught me a lot about perseverance and grit. And then finally got there.
But I'm disappointed to hear that your hope to be taken seriously when you graduated from Cornell with that degree was not met in reality necessarily. Why?
I think it really comes down to, like we said, what we were talking about earlier, is that that thing with being a woman in this industry. And what I found is people who aren't going to take you seriously with a Cornell degree are equally not willing to take you seriously with a Master of Wine.
Wow.
So it is really, really interesting how the dynamics in this industry are working right now. So it's really challenging being a woman, but it's also really rewarding when you're able to like help move people forward, like Julia was saying as well.
Yeah. So take me through then and tell listeners about sort of the career schedule, the path that you've been on since Cornell that has brought you here.
Oh my gosh. I've been all over. So I was at Cornell and I was working in the Finger Lakes at that time at Thirsty Owl Wine Company with Sean Kime. So he was one of my early mentors in the industry. And then moved out to California and worked at several wineries over the course of 9 years, ultimately ending up in Napa Valley and working with some of the most amazing fruit in the world, and really just enjoyed every minute of it. But the Finger Lakes always had a really special place in both my husband and I's hearts, and we really wanted to come back here and see what was possible. And so in 2015, we purchased our land and started our vineyard, our brand Trestle 31, and moved back to the Finger Lakes, and we were here for about 3 years. And then we were asked to move back to California to take over jobs out there. And it was one of those things where it was a job we really couldn't turn down. And so moved back.
What was the job?
Director of winemaking for Robert Mondavi Winery.
It's a household name. I want to make sure people understood what you were going out there to do. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's an iconic vineyard. Tokalon Vineyard is amazing. And, you know, I love that fruit. It's just spectacular every year. And so I wanted to see what I could do with that, just to stretch my wings a little bit. And so we moved back to Napa in 2018, but we kept Trestle 31 going. And so pre-pandemic, I was flying back and forth probably quarterly, maybe slightly more frequently than that, and keeping things going. And then my good friend at the time, and now my business partner, Byron Davis, helped me a lot keep things moving and keep things growing. And so we've been in Napa full-time since then, and we still live in Napa full-time, but we have a lot more happening here in the Finger Lakes. And so I'll be back much more frequently these days.
What's your ambition for Trestle 31, and what are you doing with it now?
Well, I really want to change the way people think about Riesling. Like, that's the core ambition. You know, I really believe that there's this consumer perception that Riesling is always sweet and it's always simple and it's an entry-level wine. And I really want people start looking at it as a fine white wine, similar to what they would look at like a fine white Burgundy or a beautiful wine from the Grove, or, you know, something like that. I want people to start thinking about it in that way versus just, oh, it's sweet and simple. And so that's what my wines really focus on, is they focus on texture and complexity and wines that have amazing ageability and really, you know, a fine white wine. And we want to kind of move the standard for what people expect from this area. And similar to being saying, like Julia and I saying, we don't want to be known as women winemakers. I don't want to be known as a great New York wine. I want to just be known as a great wine, mm-hmm. You know, not a great wine for the region. And so that's really important.
I do feel that every so often there are regions, wine regions, that are kind of the secret handshake, cool, countercultural, you know, regions on the list. Sometime in recent years, it's been the Jura seemed to be there for a while. And you always find, I mean, the Loire will always be there because it's Loire and it's great. But feels like the Finger Lakes is moving in that direction on certain wine lists in certain places, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's definitely becoming more on the radar of global industry professionals because, you know, I was approached by the WCT a few years ago to say, hey, we want to learn more about the Finger Lakes. You know, can you set us up with a tour? And then the MW program has reached out to me to get connections here. So as I'm seeing that happen, as the educational bodies are starting to say, hey, we need to include this in our study programs, that's where I know we really are gaining some solid traction, you know. And I think the more and more people that try our wines, especially in Europe, I think our wines are really tailor-made for the European palate because we are so similar in climate and in soil to what they find in Europe. So I think that's a really strong market for us. I am less happy about the Californian market for us because obviously California has such a strong domestic profile that people who love California wines are probably going to be less likely to enjoy our wines. So I think we can really gain a lot of traction by tailoring our sales towards markets that already appreciate the styles of wine that we're making.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up because I am curious to know what your colleagues in the California wine industry, not even the wine buying public, but the industry, think of the Finger Lakes, if there's a generalization.
If they think of the Finger Lakes at all,
yeah.
I think there's a lot of people who are just like, oh, that's cute. You know, and so yeah, California is such a behemoth and it's such an established industry. And it's hard to explain for folks that don't work in the California industry what it's like. And it's hard to explain for folks that don't work in the Finger Lakes industry what it's like. And so I feel like I'm this somewhat of a translation bridge mm-hmm. between the two industries.
Sure. Yeah.
And there's a lot we can learn from each other. Like, I don't think one area is better or worse off than the next. I think they're very different and they have their own challenges and very unique challenges to both areas. And I did a talk a couple of years ago, pre-COVID, to the growers in Napa talking about how they could learn from the Finger Lakes about, you know, disease management and disease pressure and how you can manage that in a smart and environmentally conscious way, you know. And so I think there's a lot of things that the Finger Lakes can learn from California, and there's a lot of things that California can learn from the Finger Lakes. But I think at this point in time, there's really not a whole lot of Finger Lakes wine on the mind of California producers.
Is some of it volume, though? Because I think if people were to actually look at the numbers, take something like Chateau Saint Michel in Washington, how much Riesling they make versus how much the entire state of New York makes in Riesling year. It's just a different scale of volume. And are we always going to be at a position in the Finger Lakes where the volume isn't enough to break through in certain ways? Or do you think that that's not right, that the quality will, even if it is a smaller volume, the quality will sort of make its own reputation and it will find its way?
I really don't believe that volume. I mean, volume is what makes you a household name. But I feel like volume is not what makes you a strong force in the industry. Like mm-hmm. you look at some of the small appellations in the Northern Rhone is a perfect example. Like some of those are only a few hundred acres. And if you're in the industry, you know about them. You know, so it's not solely a volume play. Now, I would say that those small regions in the Rhone are supported by a large, like just brand France. And brand Rhone, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah.
And so what I think we are missing here in the Finger Lakes and in New York in general is a large kind of household name volume brand that kind of supports the lower end of the industry that allows the fine winemakers to really rise up and shine with the high quality. But the volume play is how people in general public hear about you.
Talking to Nova Catamatre, who's, by the way, Trestle 31 is online. Where? Let people check out what you're doing. Where is it?
Yes, trestle31.com. We can ship anywhere in New York State, so please check us out. We have stock available, and also come see us in our Geneva Tasting Lounge. It's by appointment only, so those reservations can be made at trestle31.com as well.
Yeah, listeners, I mean, that's pretty much been the COVID story. Last year and this year, if you're wine touring at all, make appointments. Make sure you've got the time set aside, and they will be thrilled to see you. And that's true up and down the wine trail. That's wonderful. So I'm also glad you brought up California because I want to talk a little bit about the challenge of making wine in general in a world of climate change.
Yes.
So some of your colleagues in town, and I was talking to Johannes Selbach this weekend. They're having it's emotional to watch what's going on in Germany with the flooding, mm-hmm. To see entire towns where dozens of people have died and hillsides washing away. It's going to take some time to understand the impact to entire towns, let alone wine regions, et cetera. But what it is just one more awful demonstration of how difficult and how sometimes tragic climate change can be, and how when you rely on the weather, extremes can be really, really difficult. And so when we look at California winemaking, there is this idea that some people have that, well, you won't be able to make wine forever there. I don't know if that's true, but I mean, certainly alcohol levels are higher. Ripeness is higher than it was a generation ago. Where do you see it going in California?
Well, I mean, I think there's two separate issues here. So you're talking about the alcohol levels and the ripeness levels. So I don't believe that that is a function of climate change. And I know that's a radical idea, but I'll explain to you why I think that is. So a generation ago, the vineyards were very sick. They were almost all of them were virused. They were ripening at much lower Brix levels because of that. And they just were not healthy enough to reach the sugar levels that we're seeing in today's vineyards. And so there was a very big push after the phylloxera went through in California in the 1990s and everything was replanted. A lot of that was very, very healthy vineyard stock. And so much less virus flying around. You've got healthier vines. They're more robust and more efficient and they're creating more sugar. And so there are a lot of vineyards today that are ripening much easier and to higher sugar levels than there were a generation ago. So that's part of it. The other part is yeast. You know, the yeast are far more effective at converting sugar to alcohol. So you can have the same level of sugar and you'll end up with a 0.5% to 1.5% more alcohol depending on what yeast strain you're picking out. So that conversion is much more efficient. And then the other factor is the climate change factor. And what we're seeing here in Napa, well, not here in Napa, but in Napa, is that it's actually not the daytime highs that are getting hotter. It's the daytime lows, so or the evening lows, the lows at night, that are getting warmer. And so that's actually increased about 4 degrees over the last 40 years, which is quite significant.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And so what that's affecting is the acid levels, not so much the sugar levels, but the acid levels in the wine. And so as a winemaker, it's a managing how do you figure out how to adapt to that new climate. And I think we will always be able to make wine in California, but the styles may change. The variety focus may change. We're already adapting with canopy management techniques and things like that to make sure that we're not having as much sunburn. You know, there's not as much leaf pulling happening as there was, you know, even 10 years ago. So that adaptation is already happening. And I think there is this idea that climate change is this future far off thing. But if you're in agriculture, you know it's happening right now. And for me, I'm really seeing it in the extremes that's occurring. You know, so here it's either a very dry season like we had in 2020 or 2016, or it's a super wet season like we had in 18 and like we're having this year. You know, extreme amounts of rain like that crazy storm we had in 2019 that like Hector got like 9 inches of rain and people's vineyards washed into the lake, you know. And then what we're seeing in Germany, you know, those are examples of extreme weather that's happening. And no place on earth is immune from that change. And so, you know, what could be normal in the rainforest is now normal for the Southeast, you know. So yeah. I think, and it's how we adapt as winemakers is really going to be the key to how wine continues to move around the country.
Yeah, I appreciate the point so much that it's already something that's impacted. It's not just a far off issue. I mean, listening to a German winemaker this weekend at FL Excursion just talk very matter-of-factly about climate change, about how it is already an issue. Mm-hmm. He said that in a family that's been growing wine for hundreds of years, he and the current operators have had to make more change to what they can do and what and how they approach it in the last generation than in hundreds of years beforehand. So
absolutely.
And it's, in his words, all because of climate change. Now, that also means that when you are growing wine on the valley floor of California, so many people love to tour out there. They love to check it out. It's beautiful. But it's hard work. And a few years back, I interviewed Randy Dunn. I love Randy Dunn's wines, especially his Howl Mountain wines. He's a winemaker in California, and he's cantankerous, sort of famously so. And I was asking him whose wines on the valley floor in Napa that he liked. And he kind of laughed and then he pulled the phone and he started shouting like, who makes good wine anymore on the valley floor besides Kathy Corison? And then he gets back to the phone. He's like, just Kathy Corison, just her. You know, I of course disagree with him, but I had a good laugh at that. And part of what he was saying is like, we're all in a position of change. We're all going to be, if we don't adjust, we will get run out of our jobs here because the weather is going to make that impossible. You seem to be more optimistic that as long as we don't see the extremes and vineyards destroyed, whether it's frost or floods, et cetera, that adjustments can be made and you can still make great wine, whether it's Napa, Finger Lakes, et cetera.
I totally agree with that. Yeah, we're very adaptable as a species. We're very adaptable. And as long as we continue that adaptation, you know, it's a lot like, everybody kind of asks me, is wine an art or a science? And it's an art, but it's a performing art. It's one that you have to improv and improvise. And, you know, it's like jazz. And so, you know, and Julia kind of hinted at this earlier, you know, you have a plan, but you usually end up throwing the plan out the window 2 days into harvest. And so it really is something where you're making decisions on the fly. You're looking at all the factors and saying, okay, what's going to make the best wine this year? And you really are, it's a very fluid dynamic. And so as a winemaker, you have to be okay with uncertainty, you have to be okay with ambiguity, and you have to be okay with not having all the answers. And that's not for everybody as a career, you know, but that's what you have to do. And you just kind of make it up as you go along.
Now, before we let you go here, I just want to talk to you a little bit about tasting wine, because there's nobody who does it better than an MW, and you had to do it in very detailed, high pressure ways. What did you say? There were a few dozen wines you had to identify in blind settings. Is that
36
right?
Wines.
36.
Blind.
36. Yeah. Was there one that stands out as sort of funky, interesting, little off the beaten path that you enjoyed being in that lineup? Do you remember the wines from the lineup?
No, it's funny. That's the thing is, I took the exam so many times, they kind of all blur together a little bit.
But
you know, there are wines that like you are gifts in a blind lineup. Like Fino Sherry is one. Like it shows up in a lineup, and you're like, yes, I know exactly what that is. You know, and you don't have to spend a lot of time on it. Another one is like Moscato d'Asti. You know, that one's so distinctive. You know, when you get into you know, really great wine, like really amazing white Burgundy, or really amazing red Burgundy, or really amazing, you know, class growth Bordeaux. You know, those are things that you just sit there for a minute and you're like, wow, I get to taste this right now. It's so cool. You know, but there's a lot of stuff that's on the market that you're just kind of like cranking through when you're blind tasting. And there are so many meshings and meldings of styles across the international market. It's really hard these days. Like if you've got a $20 bottle of red wine, and it's an internationally marketed brand, that could be almost from anywhere. I mean, you've got stuff like that from Chile, from Australia, from California, Washington, you know, Europe. It's, you know, and so those are the really challenging wines that you have to really pick apart piece by piece. You know, it's the extremes on either end are much easier to pick, but the ones in the middle are really hard.
Well, here's why I ask. I love listening to great wine minds talk about how they taste. And wine writer for the New York Times, Eric Asimov, wrote a book about this. And you know, he thinks that we're way too fixated on coming up with 10 or 12 descriptors that, well, this wine's not like Pippin apple, it's like Gala apple. And, you know, he thinks we ought to be saying earthy or fruity, and simplifying in those directions. I agree with him if the person who's writing the notes is sort of a charlatan who's just trying to show off. But I think there are certain people who are probably in the category of, I know people hate this term, but super tasters, or just very well trained at this. How do you see, you know, what you're looking for? And then how do you talk to the general public who might feel intimidated by all of that?
Well, it's different. So there's one thing to be blind tasting professionally, like I was doing for the Master of Wine exam, which is a skill. You have to learn that. I am a super taster, but you're not born knowing what Grand Cru Burgundy tastes like. That's just not, like, you have to train to do that. So that's a key thing. And yes, you're absolutely right. I agree with Eric. I throw out the descriptors completely when I'm blind tasting, because the structure of the wine is the most important to me, and it's going to give me the most clues as to where the wine is from. So like the acid, the alcohol, the tannin structure, if it's a red, the zestiness or linearity of the acid, if it's a white, if it has sugar or not, like those are the things that really get you to a general origin. And then you use the kind of the aromatic descriptors as a last minute check, you know, it's the aromas of a wine change so much over time that I, especially in my winemaking and in my blind tasting, I almost ignore them unless they're very distinctive. Whereas if you're talking to a customer, the aroma is the first thing they see. And so if you're talking to a customer, they want to know, okay, what are you smelling? And what I typically do when I'm walking somebody through a tasting that they haven't had a lot of experience before is I'll ask them, what emotion is this bringing you? Do you have a memory that this evokes? And then we'll talk about that memory. Like one of my favorites was when I was teaching a class one time and the woman said, oh, this smells like my grandmother's attic. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Let's go into that. And so it was a Riesling. And so we started asking her about, like, can you describe the attic? What's in the attic? And she goes, oh, well, there's a window and it's open. And my grandmother had a slate roof and it was rain on the slate roof. And I remember being there and smelling these like dried roses that were up there and this rain on the slate roof. And you're like, yes, that's brilliant. I can see all of that. But if somebody just says, oh, it smells like my grandmother's attic, you're going to go, wait, what? That's not a wine descriptor. But, you know, when you're just learning the vocabulary of wine, you have to connect what your brain is telling you with a way to communicate it with other people. And so that's why I really love diving into these memories that wine evokes for people, especially people who are very new to tasting, because you get the most pure responses at that point.
That's great. 30 seconds. So you mentioned that in California, if people have heard of the Finger Lakes at all, they might say, oh, that's cute. In the future, when the region is where you want it to be, what are people going to say about it?
They're going to say this makes the best Riesling in the United States.
That was pretty easy, huh?
Yep.
I mean, it already does.
I know, but it's going to be more well-known. And it's also going to be one of the areas of the global Riesling. Like when you say, okay, where makes the best Riesling in the world? The Finger Lakes will be an automatic part of addition to that conversation.
Yeah, that's great. We had Julia Hoyle, the winemaker of Hosmer Estate Winery on Cayuga Lake earlier this hour. You can meet Julia and the whole team at Hosmer on Cayuga Lake. Set up appointments, and they do a wonderful job out there. Nova Catamatre, Trestle 31. Remind people how to find you, Nova.
Yeah, go to our website, trestle31.com, and you can have appointments for our tasting lounge and also can order our wine direct from the website.
I'm checking this one off the list. It has been way too long since I figured out a way to talk to you because I'm so thrilled you're in the industry here in the Finger Lakes. It's great to talk to you. I'm
Thank
so glad
so
we
much.
Did this.
Yeah, me too. This was fun.
Thank you very much. Nova Catamatre, Julia Hoyle, and our thanks to the whole team at WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. Hope you're listening. If you're in the Finger Lakes on 89.5 FM, they do a wonderful job and they're great partners. Rob Braden, Emma Ray Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying have a wonderful afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.